The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Deal on. All eyes on Brussels and London as breakthrough optimism grows. Pole position. Will Leo Varadkar's Brexit bounce tempt him to call a November election? Should the government be planning for a united Ireland? And because they're worth it, pay review for top civil servants earning €200,000. All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. But first, the news with Susan Jackson. Thanks, Susan. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan, and joining me tonight I have Fine Gael TD for Carlow Kilkenny, Pat Deering, Fianna Fáil TD for Louth and Junior Spokesperson on North-South Cross-Border Bodies, Cross-Border Cooperation and Cross-Border Cooperation, Declan Branagh. You have a very long title, Declan. Sinn Féin Senator Niall O'Donnell, Patricia McBride, Northern Ireland lawyer and political commentator and Irish Examiner columnist Alison O'Connor. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now, as we come to you tonight, we are hearing that Boris Johnson appears to be edging towards reaching a Brexit deal. Latest reports say that a draft text of the agreement could now be published tomorrow morning. Big health warnings over this. This is all reports of reports. What we're hearing is that the negotiating teams have agreed in principle that there will be a customs border down the Irish Sea. That's the shape of the deal that we're hearing, which of course appears quite similar to that deal that was rejected by Theresa May as a deal that no British Prime Minister could accept. Because of course this time last year, DUP leader Arlene Foster stated that there could not be a border down the Irish Sea or any differential between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
This is too important for us to be playing around with things, because this is a union. This is what brought me into politics. It's very important for us that we get this right.
But you would walk through the lobbies with Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, we haven't seen it yet, Michelle. I mean, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this issue about the need
but
to
it's a
be
question
clear.
Of you,
but
how red your red line is.
But the red line is blood red. I mean, it is very red.
And that was Arlene Foster talking about her blood red line to BBC News last October, in October 2018. This evening, Arlene Foster appeared less definitive, speaking to RTE News.
Well, as I've said, it has to be a deal, and I think it would be wrong to try and get into the modalities of all of this now. I think it is important that we have a deal that respects Northern Ireland's constitutional position as per the Belfast Agreement within the United Kingdom, and indeed respects the economic integrity of the UK single market as well.
And joining me now is the Deputy Editor of the Belfast Newsletter, Ben Lowry. Ben, we've heard since that interview that Arlene Foster gave to RTE News this evening, she's been in and out of Downing Street, and what was said on those steps of Downing Street was it would be fair to indicate that gaps remain and further work is required. How are you reading it now?
Well, I suppose the astonishing thing is that we seem to have an outline shape of what the deal would be, and that the DUP hasn't rejected it outright. I mean, their rhetoric has sometimes been very hardline, sometimes been more conciliatory. But I think that the things to look out for, that if we were in a situation where the DUP was saying that it was going to support this, and it's under huge pressure, remember, there are three or four things you'd look out for. One is an assurance that Northern Ireland would be in UK customs territory. Related to that would be the fact that Northern Ireland would benefit from trade deals. And then the other thing is some rule for Stormont. Now, I think the idea that there's going to be any veto on any side in Stormont, I think parallel consent is a way of saying that nothing ever changes. But if the British government, because you don't get parallel consent for huge things, you don't get parallel consent to change huge things is what I mean. So the British government said, this is the position, and to change it requires parallel consent, at least the DUP would be able to say that Stormont had a role, which previously it didn't. In the backstop has come and gone, and there was a revised backstop that did have a role for Stormont, and then Mrs. Theresa May's withdrawal agreement didn't. So I'm just trying to explain how the DUP might be able to agree this, but it's still pretty astonishing if they do.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the fact that they haven't stormed out of Downing Street this evening and to say that gaps remain, further work, a lot done, more to do, basically, does indicate that they are themselves on board for some kind of a deal.
They're
they want it, basically.
They're very worried. Oh, sorry. Were you asking me that?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry, Ben. I was just saying. It does. You get the sense that they really want this deal, some kind of deal.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I think that they're very anxious about no deal. The political mood is obviously not good. They're under pressure on a lot of fronts. The fact that the business community turned, particularly the Ulster Farmers Union, and made clear that no deal would be bad, all of those things have added a huge pressure on the DUP. They also have pressure over, you know, looming abortion reform in the Assembly, which isn't in Northern Ireland because there is no Assembly, which isn't a good situation. So they're not, in many respects, in a good place. They're also facing some vulnerabilities in the coming election. So there are umpteen reasons why they would very much want a deal, but there's also the fact that, let's face it, there's going to be a very significant border in the Irish Sea. Whatever happens in this, even the DUP's original concession after the Tory conference on regulations ensured that, means that this is just, it's such a big concession and such a big thing to agree to. That's the hard bit to believe in all this, despite the pressures on them to get a deal.
So do you think we could find ourselves in the same position as we found ourselves after the Chequers deal, where we thought the deal was agreed, it had got through cabinet, and then at the last minute it was the DUP that pulled the plug?
Well, I think probably what has happened historically is a little bit more complicated than that. Obviously, on the island of Ireland, we're very interested in what parties from the island of Ireland do. But I think a very interesting thing to watch with the withdrawal agreement that Theresa May did is it went through the House of Commons three times. And the numbers of Tory MPs who opposed it the first time, when it was a catastrophic defeat for Theresa May, was 118. The second time, it was something like 80. And the last time, it was 34. So remember that the last time the withdrawal agreement and the backstop went through Parliament, when Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson and co. all just did the most spectacular U-turn, having said it was very bad and divided up the UK and unthinkable, they then supported it. The DUP, that makes them isolated. So that's another possibility in this, that the DUP, you know, the DUP are not a uniform entity. Like any political party, there are different voices, there are different wings. There are some people who are keener on a deal than others. So if they can't agree a deal, it might be that Boris Johnson is just thinking that he can whittle down the Tory MPs who have real Brexit fatigue, even the hardliners, and that he can get Labour MPs and he can get it over the edge. And he's maybe saying to the DUP, do you want to be on the wrong side of that? Maybe that's the kind of thing that's being said behind closed doors.
OK, well, we'd have to wait to see what was actually said behind closed doors. Hopefully it will become clearer in the next hours and days. But for that update, Ben Lowry, Deputy Editor of the Belfast Newsletter, thank you for joining us with that this evening. Now, I want to open this to my panel. Declan.
Well, Katie,
read the runes for us.
Well, I suppose we have to welcome the fact that there is intensification of the talks, but we're all still here in the realms of speculation. I said a week ago we should be cautiously optimistic. I think it's all about the choreography of this. If we can get the text sorted tonight, I think you will see Michel Barnier, hopefully will get the opportunity to meet the 27 ambassadors tomorrow. If that doesn't happen, I think you're going to see a situation where it'll go beyond the summit. Saturday, Boris Johnson has to go to his parliament. If he can't crack a deal there, the Bend Act, as we refer to it, has to come into place. But if he can succeed in the negotiations with the EU, that cautious optimism can be that something can be cracked between now and the 31st. And I think we hope that will happen. Either way, he has to hold that special meeting on Saturday, and he will be at the hands of the Parliament.
Pat Deering, what's your read of it?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with Declan's view. I think, you know, we have to be cautiously optimistic about the situation. I wouldn't be jumping ahead too much. We've been here before, you know, to a certain extent. You know, Theresa May got the deal. The cabinet agreed to it, which included Boris Johnson at the time. It was refused or rejected on three occasions then in Parliament. And what is now likely to be suggested, or the speculation, is a similar kind of deal, the Theresa May deal, Mark II, if we could call it as such, which has been speculated.
Checkers for slow learners.
Well, call it what you like, Katie. But, you know, we're probably in a different scenario. Theresa May is different from Boris Johnson. The absolute 31st of October, I think, is an absolute deadline for Boris Johnson from his own political viewpoint. If he doesn't, in my opinion, if he doesn't get that deal by the 31st of October, his own political career is probably, his days are probably numbered. So from that point of view, I think there's an awful lot at stake. I think there's a number of difficult obstacles and hurdles in front of us still that need to be surmounted in order for this to happen. And then the choreography, as Declan says, is very important, how this transpires over the next hours and days.
And Niall, are we getting ahead of ourselves here?
No, I don't know. I think that's inevitable, in terms of the politics, the interest. I think the fundamental is we need a deal, and that remains the same today as it did the day after Brexit. But for me, I think particularly given the week that's been in it and the verdict in Belfast around Ahmed D'Souza, we need to ensure that it's a legally enforceable deal, and that's what's going to be crucial. So in terms of the EU27, in terms of the Irish government, I think they need to remain steadfast. They need to remain firm in that regard, and I understand that there may be a natural inclination at the 11th hour, but there's too much at risk here, and that's not to over-dramatise. That's because we are in the 11th hour and making that point.
I was just going to say, is there a danger? Because the gun is to everyone's head here, there's a deadline, everyone wants to get, this is our chance. Mm. Could we make a bad deal?
That's always a potential. I don't know that the gun is to everyone's head, to use your analogy, but certainly I think we just need to be very careful and ensure that the fundamentals that have been consistent throughout these last number of years around protecting the all-end economy, citizens' rights, the Good Friday Agreement, no diminution of rights, has to be front and centre in whatever the deal is. And as I said, referencing the Ahmed D'Souza case, because of our experience in dealing with the British government, any agreement has to be legally binding.
Patricia, the deal that we're hearing, if it is this deal, this is kind of what they're calling the Schrodinger's Brexit, that Northern Ireland would be both in and out of the UK customs arrangements. Mm-hmm. That could be very good economically for Northern Ireland.
Well, it'll be very bad if there isn't a deal agreed, and that's for sure. And I was quite surprised because I saw Michael Creed on Primetime just before the programme there, and he was asked to explain how that would work. And it's very simple. It's very simple. The rules don't change in terms of how things operate now on an all-island basis, but neither can the EU legislate for any internal controls between the north of Ireland and the island of Britain. So that trade will continue. The important thing from the EU's point of view is that the north of Ireland does not become, a staging post for illegal entry of goods into the rest of the EU. So that's a very, very simple process, and that's why the border needs to be in the Irish Sea from the EU's perspective. So it's interesting to see the DUP tonight coming around to that way of thinking. 10 days ago, we were hearing Geoffrey Donaldson saying, that the DUP should have a veto, and Arlene Foster tonight saying that anything that is agreed must be agreed based on the principle of consent. Well, it's quite interesting that the principle of consent is only applicable when it suits the DUP, because that's what we're seeing. And I think what has happened is that the DUP has probably realised that storming out of Downing Street is going to get them nowhere. Boris Johnson doesn't have the numbers in any case, with or without the DUP, to get a vote through unless he can get something that he can sell to the opposition in Westminster. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to get a deal that he can get through with the support of the opposition, or, this last minute scramble to try and get a deal that all may fall apart at the last minute can be blamed on the EU bureaucrats, and Boris did his best. So, whatever way Boris comes out of this, if he can get a deal he can sell, or if he doesn't get a deal, then he's coming out looking well, and fundamentally all Boris cares about is Boris.
Alison.
Yeah, I suppose...
Do we trust that everyone is doing this in good faith?
No, not at all. And I think
we
that's
hope.
As Michael Creed said, it's interesting, Pat was echoing it, but Michael Creed said it even more starkly, I suppose, in prime time, where part of what he said was the issues at the heart of squaring this circle are difficult, if not intractable. And I mean, it'll be fascinating to watch, if a deal is struck, how Boris Johnson manages to sell that. And actually, if he sells it successfully, from a cynical point of view, it'll be very depressing to watch it in terms of where politics are at. Do you know what I mean? The full turnaround and how politics is in the UK at the moment. I think the danger here is we're all so sick of it, we're all so fed up that it's very hard to look at it, A, dispassionately, B, not to get overexcited at the prospect that maybe something will be done. But when you look at the cold, hard reality of it and all that has gone through over the last couple of years, it's nigh on impossible to imagine how a deal that involves lots of technicalities, and as I heard Tony Connolly say earlier, technology and stuff that has never been used anywhere. You know, so if you just look at the facts like that in sort of bullet point, it's virtually, you wish it to be the case, you want it to work out, but it's very, very difficult to imagine that. And just to end on the point about, you know, how different was this to Theresa May's deal and all of that, you'd have to say, I agreeing with the former Cabinet Minister Amber Rudd, who said today, you know, that she felt there was a real whiff of misogyny about this, that Theresa May couldn't get it through, and now that possibly Boris would. And it's hard not to agree with her on that.
But it's hard to believe we're having this conversation here tonight, given, like, a few days ago, a week ago, everybody was convinced that Boris had no interest in a deal, that all his billionaire cronies wanted a no-deal Brexit. They wanted, to benefit from the pound crashing. And that was the analysis that was kind of very widely circulated.
Well, I mean, I don't know my co-panelists that well, but I mean, I think that the people who are gathered in the room were all, we'd like to think, relatively sane and quite honest, upstanding members of the community. And if you were to present me with an issue relating to any of them, we might try and look at it logically and with a degree of sanity and based on past experience. That's virtually impossible when it comes to Boris Johnson. And that's one of the really difficult things in reading the ruins to go to earlier.
I would go further to suggest, and I think we need to be very careful with the language you use, not to cause harm to what is going on currently.
Yes, but the issue.
Yeah, listen, do you want to withdraw that comment?
No, I'm not asking her to withdraw, but I'm just saying I think it's incumbent, not just on this programme, but on other programmes over the next 48 hours, that people would be sensitive to all sides in this dispute. But more importantly, I think your listeners are getting fed up of it, but the people along the border know what the implications were for a hard Brexit. And I do think that Boris, coming late to the table, does realise that he can't square those circles. And the respite that I would see for the people in this country would be he can move on to other things, and particularly the East-West relationships, because everybody on this island knows it seems to have gone amiss to a lot in British politics, that the best of both worlds for the all-Ireland economy, and particularly for the Northern Ireland economy, is essential that the deal that we're hearing is hopefully about to happen will allow us grow that all-Ireland economy, and that particularly Northern Ireland will have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I just wanted a couple of texts in. One here. Europe will throw Ireland under a bus before Boris blinks. Anyone thinks they have our best interests at heart were born post 2011 or has a bad memory, to say the least. That's from Des, who is texting us from the border. Our text number 51551. Europe has stood. There hasn't been a blink from Europe, even though many people predicted it.
No, absolutely, Kate. You know, Europe has stood 110% square behind Ireland from day one. And I think that has been, I suppose, a fair indictment of the situation we're in at the moment. You know, there has been no deviation since the 23rd of June 2016 until where we are today now, whatever day is, the 15th of October, or is it the 14th, whatever day it is. And along the way, there has been no change. There's been constant communication and engagement with all our European colleagues, and every one of them have been four square behind us, which has been, I think, I suppose, in fairness, I think it's been a testament to our own people who have been dealing with Simon Coveney, Helen McEntee, our Taoiseach, two Taoiseachs, past and present, in that regard. And it shows, I suppose, the standing they are within the European community as well.
Patricia.
We also have to bear in mind that part of the impetus behind Boris Johnson and the British government at the moment is the calls from pro-Brexit voices in Britain to get Brexit done. This is the mantra we keep hearing, get Brexit done. But the difficulty with that mantra is that once the withdrawal agreement is in place, that is only the start of the negotiation. So Brexit's not going to be done for many years. And I saw someone on Twitter this morning saying, you know, that if the EU thinks that they can get Britain out of Europe after only 3 years, when it's taken us almost 800 years in Ireland, they're kidding themselves. Yeah. So moving on to the next phase, you have to look at, you know, the relationships around, because what we're talking about now is purely trade. Doesn't deal with services, doesn't deal with citizens' rights, doesn't deal with lots and lots of issues that have to be put into the negotiations on the future arrangement. Those are going to be the bigger sticking points than a simple trade agreement. If we think we have problems now, wait 2 years.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to, before I leave this, I want to go over to Brussels for a minute and talk to Darren McCaffrey, political editor for NBC News, just to see what the latest word in Brussels is tonight. Darren, what are you hearing?
Well, the talks are definitely ongoing. In fact, they're expected to go on beyond midnight. Here, of course, it's coming up to 11:30. And today we've really had kind of deal, then it's no deal, then we had optimism, then we had pessimism. But ultimately, I think, you know, while there is clearly the political will to get a deal, the complexity of it all is proving, I think, slightly too much. And when you factor into this idea that the EU are feeling increasingly uncomfortable with Northern Ireland staying de facto inside the EU's customs union, but actually legally still inside the UK's customs territory, how that practically works is clearly the big stumbling ground in all of this. And you have to add into that that Downing Street aren't just negotiating with the EU Commission tonight in Brussels, but also, of course, with many of their own MPs and the DUP. Two notable things in the last hour: that the DUP suggesting that there are still massive gaps when it comes to this. And apparently, according to the Sun newspaper in the last couple of minutes, many of the Eurosceptics, such as Ian Duncan-Smith and Owen Paterson, are not on board with this deal as it stands. So I expect these negotiations are going to continue late into tonight. At the moment, you'd have to conclude that it's looking increasingly unlikely that they'll have a legal text at that summit on Thursday. And we may well have to see another EU Council summit before the October 31st deadline.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Darren, thanks very much for bringing us that update. That's not very positive, is it?
Sounds very realistic, though.
Yeah,
it's realistic, but a legal text is, you know, can be a short sort of extension to allow for that if the agreement is there in principle, could probably be facilitated.
And as I've said earlier, if there's a will, there's a way. If we can't get to Thursday for the European Council, there's no reason why a special European Council can't be called before the 31st. Yeah. If there's a sincerity about getting this deal across the line. If not,
Dancing to this October 31st deadline?
I think there's a key point made there in terms of your last contributor, that Boris isn't just negotiating with EU27, and that has been the problem that has plagued this process consistently. And it's not that he's just negotiating with the ERG and the kind of Brexiteers within his own party, but he's still negotiating with the DUP. It's clear, and within the DUP they're negotiating with each other. This is why I think, you know, we rightly erred on the side of cost at the beginning of this contribution, because, you know, we've been up and down today, and here it seems, going by that latest detail, we're probably a wee bit back down again.
A couple of more texts in. Alison and company display a brazen bias against Boris and the UK. The real challenges lie ahead once Britain makes a success of Brexit. Well, I think Patricia was making that point. Watch the French and the Germans. Our 12.5% tax will be under attack. That's Aidan from Longford. Watch out, the light at the end of that tunnel may be an oncoming train. That one doesn't have a name attached to it. We'll take a break there, but stay with us because we want to talk about the latest opinion polls after this.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. In studio tonight, we have Fine Gael TD Pat Deering, Fianna Fáil TD Declan Brannock, Sinn Féin Senator Niall O'Donnell,
Patricia McBride, Northern Ireland lawyer and political commentator, and Irish Examiner columnist Alison O'Connor. You can text us on 51551. Now to the latest opinion poll, this one by Ipsos MRBI for the Irish Times. It has good news for the Taoiseach. Leo Varadkar's approval rating has jumped 15 points since May, with a 51% share now saying they are satisfied with his performance as Taoiseach. Fine Gael, steady at 29%. That's 4 points ahead of Fianna Fáil at 25%. Support for Sinn Féin has fallen to its lowest level since the 2016 general election at 14% in this poll, while the Green Party has doubled its support since the last poll to 8%. So, Pat Deering. Apparently febrile atmosphere around Leinster House today. Chatter from Fine Gael about an election growing all over again. Will this bounce from Brexit change Leo Varadkar's mind about timing of the election?
I mustn't have been part of that conversation today, Katie, I'm afraid. You know, but this is one poll of many polls over the last period of time. It's obviously encouraging from a party point of view and from a government point of view. But, you know, from an election point of view, the Taoiseach's indicated last July 12 months, I think, when he wrote to Micheál Martin that his preferred time for a general election would be May 2020, which is next May, in order to create or to do away with the uncertainty that has been there. Micheál Martin has indicated that he would be supporting the government until Brexit was done, and has been indicated already Brexit mightn't be done for many years. So, you know, I do think it's, you know...
What are you suggesting?
I think you're being a bit sceptical. No. Everything is going to go on forever.
No, I'm a bit...
Where are your posters, Pat?
My posters are ready since the last election, as they always have been, and will be whenever the time comes, Katie. The election will take place sometime between now and probably next May, in my opinion.
That leaves a total possibility of it taking place in November.
Sure, as I say, any time between now and there's no doubt we're a day closer to it than we were yesterday. That's for certain, Katie. You know, but the Taoiseach has indicated that his preferred time would be next May.
What would be your preferred time?
Well, it's not up to me, Katie. Obviously, whenever it happens, it happens.
I'm just asking your personal opinion, Pat.
I'd be ready if he calls election tomorrow morning, Katie. I'd be ready if he calls.
Do you think it would be a good idea to go on the back of if there was a good Brexit outcome, given that we can see that the last time we had a good poll showing for Leo Varadkar, it was on the back of the last good Brexit outcome, or what we thought was a good Brexit outcome at that time? Do you think it would be a good idea to capitalise on that and not go through the trolley crisis?
You're presuming there's going to be a trolley crisis. And
well, should we already have a trolley crisis? Is it not even November yet?
And a housing crisis.
Yeah, but on the issue, let's say, you know, whenever the election takes place, call it, it'll take place. And it'll be up to the Taoiseach to call the election, most likely.
Will you tell us what you think?
Well, I think it doesn't make that much difference, Katie. I'm just a mere backbencher, Katie. Well, when the election calls, I get the posters, dust it down and put them up and campaign the same as I always do. You know, this is just one opinion poll of many. It's encouraging. There's no doubt about that.
But is it encouraging to the degree, though? It is obviously encouraging in that there's no slump, and obviously it's a big jump for Leo Varadkar. But that sheen isn't rubbing off on the party. The party is well below the highs of the, you know, early to mid-30s that it did enjoy earlier on in its life.
Yeah, well, the party's polling ratings have been quite consistent over the last year or thereabouts. Kind of 30% in or around, and probably an average of maybe 28, 29% in the last maybe, whatever, 6 or 7 polls, approximately. You know, I'm not surprised at the opinion poll showings in this particular poll. You know, it has been... All the talk has been
about... Would you not think that if the party leader takes a big bounce, that he would pull the party up with him?
That may happen in due course, Katie, when the election does take place. And when the election does take place, it will take on a world of its own. It'll be Brexit maybe for the first day. If it was to take place in November, I'm not suggesting it's going to take place in November, but if it was going to take place in November...
For instance, Katie,
I'm sure it might be about Brexit for the first week. The second week, it could be about something else. And then the third week, it may be about something else. So, you know, there'll be a number of issues in the election campaign, whenever it is, be it in...
So you think it would be a mistake to kind of imagine that just because we kick off on a good Brexit note that will be what would dominate the campaign?
Absolutely. I think every election campaign takes on a life of its own.
Okay. Declan, what do you think?
It's clear. It's either going to be November, if Leo thinks he has the bounce, February, or... Micheál Martin's description, I think, is early 2020. Now, if that could be early in the new year, or it could be certainly as far away as May. As far as I can see, it was important that the confidence supply would remain until we got Brexit sorted out. We give a commitment of four budgets. We've done that, and I think we're getting nearer. And I think most politicians have been, I say, ever ready, believe it or not, from the formation of this last Dáil. It's almost lasted 4 years. I don't think anybody would have thought it. Mm-hmm. In the context of Fianna Fáil, we view it as steady as you go. It was important to try and get this Brexit issue stabilised, but the election is looming, and I think most people are prepared, ready and waiting, and have the posters ready for recycling.
If you're a betting man, when do you think it's going to happen?
I do think that it could go as far as next May, but if a betting man, I would say February.
Were you around Leinster House today? Did you have any sense of this?
Yeah,
febrile.
Absolutely. First of all, there's almost an eerie silence around the house that people are in their offices. I don't know what they're doing, but certainly
they're in their
talking to their constituents.
Maybe
their printers. But I do believe that there is a rump of people there who want a November election. And if that's to happen, bring it on. But I think people have to be responsible to ensure that this deal is cemented and sealed. And that's up to Leo after that. But Micheál Martin has made it very clear and will continue to make it clear. He said he would see the four budgets through. And
well, he's done that now, sure.
And it's early. Yes, I think you asked me for...
Was the finance bill to go through?
Yes, and I think that's the reason I'm calling February. Mm. I think between the finance bill and social welfare
and
bill, that has to be sorted.
Yeah, well, I think in fairness, Micheál Martin has said that if Leo Varadkar cuts and runs ahead of getting those bills sorted, that it will be a stroke.
Well, you know...
Look, yeah, I mean, I think that the signals are confusing because Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are both sending out their own sort of separate signals for their own party political reasons. I think saving Pat's presence, he's telling us porkies if he said he wasn't in either that or he's not running the next time. The notion that you weren't involved in febrile or otherwise in discussion today on the possibility of an election. To my mind this morning, I wrote a column last week saying I thought that, you know, there would be November was pointing more towards November. And even more so having seen the poll results this morning, for that reason that shows Fine Gael staying static as a party and yet such a bounce for the Taoiseach and indeed the increase in government satisfaction, that even if there is an extension, you have, that's the difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, is Brexit, is the government's handling of Brexit. That's what gives them more of a unique selling point, if you like. And even if it's an extension and they're saying we have to go back in now and negotiate, do you want us, the team that is known in the EU, who've done very well so far and we're completely match ready, or do you want Fianna Fáil, who've merely been observing on this side? And I think it would also be a massive advantage for Fine Gael not to have sort of winter trolley crisis. If we have flu, housing is always worse. Publicity around that, housing is always worse in the winter. And I also think that you look at something today like what happened in the Dáil, where the Taoiseach spoke about the death of the man in Cork, and he spoke...
The homeless man.
The homeless man, Mr. Howran, and I should remember he's from Bantry in West Cork, where I'm from myself, and his Christian name has just gone out of...
Timothy.
Indeed, yeah. Thank you, Timothy Aaron. A real tragedy. But where the Taoiseach spoke about that in response to a question from Micheál Martin, and I felt it would have been entirely legitimate for him to say, as he did, that Mr. Harran had been, assistance had been offered to him, he'd been offered an apartment. But then to have to tag on to it, you know, all funded by the government, is that thing that Leo Varadkar does, where I think he has this need always to be right. Mm. And it's not, that's not good politically. And I think that's the fear his party have of him in a general election. My final point is, I wouldn't like to be Sinn Féin on the back of the their rating at the poll.
I was just going to go to our Sinn Féin panellist. Niall, yeah, that poll was shocking for... Like 14% was the overall level, but if you go into the data in it, 7% in Dublin for Sinn Féin. That's extraordinary.
There's a lot to take from it. I think Alison's right in that the election and its calling will depend on what happens over the next few days, and
the short next few weeks. But I suppose, I mean, it would be a very standard politician answer to say a poll's a poll. But certainly the polls have changed for us. We were 20% in a poll not too long ago. These things ebb and flow. In terms of an election, we're ready for it. We're up for it. We think we have a good record, not least in terms of our alternative budget last week.
Was that not frightening, though, that poll, and particularly in terms of Dublin?
No, I'm not dismissing polls either, but I'm not frightened. I don't think Sinn Féin's frightened of an election. We're ready for it. We're up for it. It certainly isn't reflective of the feedback we're getting either internally after the last election or indeed what we're getting on the doors.
You did not have a great local election in particular.
Yeah.
And we heard after that there was going to be soul searching and deep analysis of you know, how you can deal with that. So, like, have you got a handle on where it's going wrong for you?
I think so. And there has been a major review north and south. The party's reflecting on that. And I think the party are already back out of the traps in terms of addressing some of the issues coming from that internal review. And I'm sure this poll will play a part in people's thinking and people's response. But as I say, it's only one of many polls. The real poll that matters is the poll.
But what are your analysis? Because people are scratching their heads. Like a lot of commentators had bought into the analysis that, you know, after 30 years with Gerry Adams at the helm, that, you know, a fresh, young, Dublin-based leader would, you know, open up support for the party, particularly in Dublin and you know, outside of the border counties. And the opposite seems to have happened. You're hemorrhaging support in those very places where you had been targeting.
Well, not entirely. I mean, one poll will show you something entirely different in terms of what has happened. But, I mean, you're right. I accept and concede the election wasn't great for us. I think we've learnt those lessons. And we'll go out and fight this election, I think, on the very positive campaign of what we've offered in Leinster House over the last few years. What we've offered, I think, crucially, as an All-Ireland party in relation to the Brexit scenario and the influence we've brought to bear here in terms of the Irish government's response, but also at a European level as well. So, as I say, I'm not being dismissive of this poll. It's important that we absorb it and learn from it, but certainly it doesn't frighten me, to use your own term there, Kitty. I certainly sense, as I say, internally and indeed externally, and I've been on doors north and south, Sinn Féin are up for an election, and we'll go out and fight that election positively, and I think we'll do well from the last local government one.
Patricia?
Well, I think just following on from what Niall said, Sinn Féin probably has to take a hard look at why some of its core constituencies just didn't turn out. If you look at places like Darndale and Coolock, they had some of the lowest turnouts in the local elections, which traditionally would have been very high Sinn Féin voting areas. Now,
A symptom of broader politics.
But
I think it's
also an issue that the party itself needs to look at, because I mean, if you look at it's very important, you know, that worthy international humanitarian causes are highlighted. You know, issues like this week around Catalonia and what is happening there. It's very important that people are aware of that. But that's not relating to the people on the doorsteps in places like Darndale and Coolock. So I think the party has a lot of work to do with its traditional grassroots in saying what it is that Sinn Féin is doing in Leinster House that's relevant to them.
We have a PMP on a living wage tonight, and I think that's an important one. So again, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. There tonight, we're bringing forward legislation on a living wage, which I think impacts right across society, and it'll be an important one that people really.
But on the bigger issue, the broader issue, of the opinion polls, I don't think that we should conflate support for the Taoiseach with support for Fine Gael.
But it's not. It's obviously not conflated in these figures.
The reality is that probably the majority of people in that poll are saying, you know what, the Taoiseach has represented us well internationally. You know, he's made us look good. We're calm. You know, we're mature. We're politically competent on the international stage. And there's a lot there that, you know, we feel proud of as a nation. Saying, you know, this, we may not always agree with him, but you know, he's doing it. You know, he looks well out there, for want of a better expression. But the reality is, when Pat goes out in Carlow Kilkenny, I don't know how many people are going to ask him about Brexit at the doorsteps? How many people are going to say, well, hold on a wee second, you know, this is, I'm going to vote based on how your party performed in the Brexit negotiations.
I think we've reached such saturation point. I think purely if on the basis of the people just want it over. You know, but I think Irish people do actually care about how we look internationally. And I think people do care about, what it means for the North and that the protection of the Good Friday Agreement and that. I think that is important to people. And I think even what we saw during the summer with the murder of Lyra McGee and that, I think it really brought home to people, the fact of the Stormont being closed, that it isn't a victimless crime, you know, in terms of that needing to be sorted out and how all of that is enmeshed. So I think that because it's such a universal thing and there's no getting away from it, even if you don't want to care about it, you kind of have to.
But when you vote on it, is my point, and you're more likely to vote. I think you're more likely to vote on the economy, on healthcare, and housing.
I mean, I agree they're the more solid things, but sometimes there are intangibles.
Speaking of that particular intangible, to bring you the very latest, Pat Leahy, the political editor of the Irish Times, is tweeting: "Everyone tight-lipped, but as of now, seems deal is on the way. Could have all changed now." It's a caveat. Could all have changed by the time we wake up tomorrow, though. But crucial thing is, all sides want a deal. I just want to give you some of the reactions, because we're getting a lot of reaction, as you can imagine, on this political discussion. I can't understand these polls. Leo going up, health, housing, law and order, all in deep doo-doo. I'm amazed, says David in Dublin. Taoiseach Varadkar would best advised to call to mind the fate of Gareth Fitzgerald in general election post his work on Ireland-Britain relations. He lost the 87th general election badly. That's from Moira Nigolig. Can the next election show some environmental consideration and have all election posters banned? Ugly and blight on landscape, no need for them, or the cable ties which they inevitably leave behind?
Ugly's a bit harsh.
And a couple for you, Niall. When will Sinn Féin ditch Mary Lou on the slide since she became leader? That's from Andrew Murphy in Kilkenny. And Matt Carthy would be, this is not from Andrew, it's from another texter, Matt Carthy would be a good choice as leader. Is there any discussion at all within Sinn Féin about Mary Lou's leadership?
None whatsoever.
I didn't make a contribution yet, but I think everybody has to examine their own party and how they're doing. I think in relation to Fianna Fáil, the reason we're slowly rising in the polls is that we have been responsible. We've taken a responsible attitude towards the major issues of the day. We saw the need, going right back to form a government, when people sat on their hands for 70 days, and some people may have forgotten that.
Sorry, I forgot that I hadn't allowed the 2-minute party political broadcast.
I know, but I'm going to give an analysis of that.
I think Fianna Fáil's election manifesto is actually going to consist of a collective rosette pinning for their incredible services to the country.
I do think we have been responsible. We have to accept we made mistakes, as many did in the past, and that's quite.
Given the situation with housing, given the situation with the health service, given the debacle of the National Children's Hospital, given the debacle of the National Broadband, you're still trailing Fine Gael in the polls.
I don't think we're trailing Fine Gael in the polls.
In this poll you are. You're four points behind Fine Gael in this poll.
We're slowly gaining ground, and I do accept that the issues
so
that you've
referred to... So is there not questions to be asked about given all the gifts that have been handed to you, that you're still where you are.
If I could answer, I think that responsibility has been transcribed, and Fianna Fáil have taken over 40 bills in this current Dáil. We've tried to stamp certain influences within the parameters of the confidence play on policy. But I was going to offer advice if they would take it to Sinn Féin. I do honestly believe, from my being on the ground, that while I fully accept they have had an abstentionist policy in relation to taking seats, either in Westminster or indeed the troubles they had in Stormont, that people are beginning to see that you have to get involved democratically. And I think that's where your difficulty is, if I might suggest it.
It's not.
You experience that difficulty.
It's not at all.
I'm on the ground in my own constituency, and that's the feeling.
Every nationalist constituency in the North returned an abstentionist MP after
the Brexit.
But let's see how this
works. So there's no appetite from within nationalism for people to go to the House of Chaos.
I have to agree with Niall on this one. Abstentionism is only an issue for people in this part of Ireland. People in the north see their political home in Dublin. They see their long the nationalist Republican people.
In order
in the
to get there, you have to get the institutions up and running to become an all-Ireland
economy. They don't see that their long-term political home is in Westminster, and they don't
I didn't say that.
Abstentionism
was fine for Declan and others when we all went round to the Mansion House and celebrated the centenary of the first Dáil, an abstentionist parliament created by abstentionist MPs. It was fine.
Living in history and moving on to what is growing the all-Ireland economy.
If you think that's the case, run a candidate in East Belfast where
I live. Well, we are working in partnership with the SDLP, and I'm quite sure.
It didn't work out too well for the SDLP taking their seats at Westminster, did it?
Okay, well, let's just take a break, and because there's a couple of more things I want to move on to before we finish up.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, pay for the country's top civil servants should be reviewed because of an ongoing difficulty in attracting talent to that grade. So says the Public Service Pay Commission. The most senior grade of civil servants currently earn €197,117. And of course, they also qualify for very good pensions. Dare I say, gold-plated. What do we think about this? Declan, do you think the most senior civil servants... what we pay them needs to be reviewed.
Look, I'm sure you're listening.
And obviously by reviewed we mean increased.
I'm no doubt your listeners out here are listening in and say the figures you've mentioned are astronomical. Mm. But the reality is that there are niche areas apparently, and I've only looked at this report briefly this evening, that they're indicating they're having difficulty recruiting people. I haven't got specifics on them. It does say that they've no difficulty, for example, in getting radiographers and psychologists and people, paramedics and such like. But I'm a member of the Budgetary Oversight Committee, and the issue has come up in relation to even not just in the public service, but the need to give breaks, even tax breaks, in large companies in order to attract people of the calibre that have been sucked out to other areas. They may sound gross figures and figures that, you know, people would only dream of winning as a lotto. But
you see, I have been constantly told that we have the most brilliant civil servants, particularly our senior civil servants, that we could ever hope for. First time I've heard that there is some sort of a talent
There is a talent drain because they've been attracted elsewhere. That's what we've been told. I have to take the report and dissect it. I think people will dissect it before people will reach the conclusion that there is need to increase the pay. But look at in some of the areas where you want to get top-class people, if they've been sucked out to other countries and we don't have the capacity to attract them, let's be fair, it's happening in relation to even teaching posts. People are going running to Abu Dhabi.
When was the last time a Secretary General was attracted out of their post?
Well, I can't answer that, but I'm only looking at what the report is saying.
Yeah, the figure is gross, and the figures have been quoted are gross in both sense of the word. You know, and we seem to do so well with this whole L'Oreal because I'm worth it vibe, you know, throughout
banking,
you know, semi-state. I mean, that Paul Reid, the new head of the HSE, is on 300,000. And one argument for that is, God, if he sorted things out, I'd give him 600. But yet, that's because the government has allowed the health situation get so bad. That's why, that's your natural reaction. Pay that man if he can do it, great. I just think that... I'm not sure what the answer is, because if there are, as Declan says, that it's been shown there is brain drain in certain areas, clearly then our governance and our public services suffer through not having talent at the top and running them. But yet there is obviously a desire for far too much money to be paid to do the jobs.
I mean, we shouldn't assume it's all down to the money issue either. There are other conditions and other factors and that might be at work there, and I think that's why Declan's sensible in his approach at looking at the report. But what concerns me...
No, but I'm talking about specific... No, there are several areas, and I'm thinking particularly of hospital consultants, where we know that there is an international market for hospital consultants, and we have huge, huge issues in recruiting them, and there has been a huge delay in addressing that issue. I'm saying, in terms of the most senior civil servants, and that there has been a submission from the Department of Public Expenditure into this report, basically stating that that there is a continuing difficulty in attracting candidates for certain high-level posts due to constraints on remuneration.
Well, if we take a minute to just if you will indulge me and look at some of the less senior employees, there's over 2,000 people employed by government departments who aren't getting a living wage, who are earning less than €12 an hour. I think that's something we need to be taking into consideration before we get into, I would agree, the gross salaries that some of these people are getting. So to me, that seems like much more than a fair living wage, and I would suspect that it obviously has something more to do with the salary issue, as we've acknowledged, and that's what obviously needs addressed in terms of retention. But we can't keep thinking that we can throw money at this in order to solve it, particularly when we look at the other elements of civil service, like 366 people in the Department of Foreign Affairs who aren't being paid a living wage. That, to me, in this day and age, when you look at even
the clerical officer grade.
It's across the department. The revenue commissioners have over 1,200 people not earning a living wage. So I think stand us in good stead to have a conversation about that.
Let Pat in.
I just want to come back on what a civil servant is. It doesn't necessarily mean they're a pen pusher.
No, of course, but I mean the civil servants and public servants, and you know.
I wasn't suggesting that.
No, I know you weren't. Sorry, what I'm saying is, we need to see what the definition. We're not necessarily, in my view, talking about people who are in departments.
Sure.
Formulating policy. I did say at the outset, if we can give a list of people who are public servants.
This particular report specifically is about the people at the highest levels.
They made it clear that radiographers, psychologists, some of those are civil servants. They took public service dentists, they took national emergency operations, and indeed paramedics, who are, for all intents and purposes, civil servants. I think we need to be clear that who we're talking about. I do think that the amount of money we're talking about is enormous, but we've got to digest the report and see, is there a problem?
Okay.
Sorry.
Pat.
You know, I like others, I've only seen this report this evening. I just looked ahead in a small bit of detail, and I do think, and I think I would agree with everybody on the panel, that the money that we're talking about is astronomical, and you would imagine that anybody earning 200,000 would be, you know, in a good position. But I do think it's important from a public service point of view that we have the will to attract and maintain the brightest and the best in the country, if we can at all, and attract those who would appear to have, we are in competition for, if you go back to the areas that Declan referenced, you know, we need to be able to attract these people, be it the consultants, be it radiographers and so on. So that's where we're falling down now at the moment. If you go back to hospital waiting list, for example, you know, we can't get these people. And we have to ask the question, why can't we get them? Because we're under competition, we're in competition with other countries who are probably paying better, to have a better living situation.
But in the case of hospital consultants in particular, because you brought it up there, Pat Dearing. Why do we have a situation, if you ask the IHCA, it's because of a political decision that was taken by James Riley, a Fine Gael minister. How long ago is that now? 2011, 2012. That's why.
Yeah, but that was there.
And we're now paying the price of that decision. That's according to the Hospital Consultants Association.
I wouldn't disagree. But that was then and this is now. We're in a situation now where, at the time, we just didn't have the money to pay these people. And unfortunately, there was cutbacks straight across the board because of the situation that, from a government point of view, we inherited from Declan's party at the time. You know, but I do think, go back to the main point, you know, it is important that we are able to attract and keep the best people in positions of leadership in our public and civil service. You know, I don't take
yeah,
benefits
on board.
Take on board.
If you have the money to pay across the board.
I don't take on board. It's people.
Well, there's two very, very brief things to say. The first is that the number of secretaries general is quite small. So the number of people at that highest level of pay is quite small. It's in the less than 10, I would imagine. The second thing is, if you look across the public sector, the civil service, there needs to be an analysis and a root and branch reform of all pay scales. When you have a situation where an able seaman rescuing refugees from the Med is getting less than an administrator,
you have a difficulty and you need to look at that. Okay, I'm going to have to go. I should read out one text here. If 200,000 is too much gross for high-level civil servants, what about broadcasters getting more than twice that, says in Kilkenny. That's my salary, obviously, is out there. So just time for a couple of headlines. All the British papers have gone with the Brexit deal. Johnson close to a Brexit deal. Now he has to sell us, says The Guardian. Johnson hit by prospect of no-deal Brexit until 2020, says The Times. Johnson pressed to yield more ground and race to find a Brexit deal, says The Financial Times. That's all we have time for. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally and Sinead Mooney. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Jamie Doyle was on sound. I want to thank my panel and go over now to Colin Murray on Late Date.